Good afternoon, and welcome to the Easter Seals Project Action Online Conference on Pedestrian Access, Making Streets Accessible to All. All participants will be in listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity to ask questions during today's presentation. At that time, the operator will give instructions on how to ask questions. If you should need assistance during the conference, please signal the operator by pressing star, then zero on your touch-tone phone. This conference is being recorded. I would like to turn the conference over to Christy Ross. Ms. Ross, you may begin.
Thank you very much, LaTanya. Welcome to everybody. Easter Seals Project Action is happy to be with you again today, presenting the second session in a series of three for the online conference on pedestrian access. The title of the conference is Building Livable Communities Through Increased Pedestrian Access. And the session today is titled Making Streets Accessible to All and will be presented by Michael Ronkin, a consultant. Easter Seals Project Action has partnered with the National Center on Senior Transportation and the Pedestrian and Bicycle Information Center to bring this series of sessions to you. I want to thank both organizations for their hard work and expertise on the project. For those of you that are new to Project Action, we will hear in just a minute from my colleague Ken Thompson. He's going to give you a brief overview of the services we provide. This session is being brought to you via phone and internet. Instructions were given to all registered participants via email. If you're having trouble connecting to the internet portion of the event, please email Stan Tibbs at stibbs@easterseals.com, and that's stibbs@easterseals.com. I want to remind everybody that the call is being recorded and transcribed. And if you want a copy of the transcript, you can visit our website, which is projectaction.org, in about 30 to 45 days to get the PDF or text format. Or if you want a copy in Braille or audio CD, you can make that request to espa.distancelearning@easterseals.com. This is the second session, as I mentioned, in a three-part series on pedestrian access. The final session will be tomorrow, May the 20th, and it will be presented by Peter Lagerway of the Tool Design Group, and the final session is titled The Power of 25. During each session, we're going to be providing information about the co-sponsors. And as I mentioned a second ago, we're going to have Ken Thompson with us today. He's our technical assistance contract specialist, and he's going to tell you a little bit about Project Access.
Yes. All right. Welcome, everybody. I want to just spend a few minutes giving you an introduction on Easter Seals Project Action and trying to give you an overview of what we do, what we provide, and how you may contact us to help you out with some of your problems around accessible transportation. Now, Easter Seals Project Action has been around since 1989, and its mission is to promote universal access to transportation for people with disabilities under federal law, such as the ADA or the Americans with Disabilities Act, and going beyond to partnering with transportation providers, the disability communities, and others through the provision of training, technical assistance, applied research, outreach, and communication. What we do also is we like to assist service providers, we like to assist customers, planners, and especially, we like to assist you with technical assistance. And we attempt to assist anyone who contacts us. So it's all callers. We're kind of the place you call us, and we try to work out solutions to your issues or your problems or find resources that might be helpful. Core areas that we do is training, such as the session you're involved in now, technical assistance by phone or email or sometimes in person. Applied research, that's research that offers solutions that can be used in the field, such as guidebooks. Outreach through websites, the newsletter, our research material developments and conferences, plus advisory committees, and, of course, our free online store of various materials. Now, in the online store, we have print resources that are available, such as pocket guides, the ADA general information, taxi operators' guides, bus operators' guides, motor coach operator guides, all these kinds of easy-to-use documents, easy to carry, can be useful in training, and also just getting that information out to people of interest. other training materials are related to broader efforts such as competencies for the practice of travel instruction, travel training. That's a document that really provides a lot of guidance for someone actually putting together a travel training program where you're looking at who actually provides the travel training and then what students who are learning travel training really would need to know to be successful. We also produce toolkits such as our bus stop toolkit on accessibility and safety, and we produce additional other kinds of reports, guides, and findings in brief. One of the findings in brief that we produce fairly recently, it's called the Accessible Pathways to Bus Stops and Transit Facilities, a Process Guide. A resource that was developed part of this effort is was created by the Institute of Transportation Engineers in association with the Tool Design Group, and the Tool Design Group will actually be a speaker for tomorrow, but it's a guide that walks stakeholders through the steps for improving sidewalks, road crossings, and other elements of the travel path on the way to and from bus stops or to rail and transit stations. And the Accessible Pathways Process Guide helps people identify goals, conduct a community report card, and then to prepare an action plan. And the interesting part to that is also there's a section on ensuring follow-up. So how do you make sure that you're successful when you go through all these steps? So it's also a guide that includes key information on issues of accessible pathways with descriptions on current thinking around universal design and has some good case study summaries from 12 communities around the nation. Another document just fairly recently completed that might be of interest to you, too, is the Accessibility Design Guide for Bus Rapid Transit Systems. If you're not familiar with Bus Rapid Transit Systems, it is really a hybrid service which shows characteristics of both bus and rail. Known most commonly as BRT, it can provide reduced travel times or rail-like vehicle travel on transitways or has stops that are similar to rail. Now, the document describes accessible design elements that apply to BRT systems, both from the regulatory perspective of the ADA and ADAG, as well as the concept of universal design, and with the goal, basically, of producing systems that are barrier-free, that are accessible for everyone. Part of the design guide is a volume 2, which includes an ADA compliance checklist, which could be used as a self-assessment tool. And what this design checklist does basically is it takes the regulations and then lists all the various elements and regulations, which shows how are you in compliance and how are you not. So it's pretty important as far as when you're designing your system. We also offer online courses in various formats. It may include readings, activities, teleconference. Some include a lot of interaction. Some include fairly little. Some are flexible to allow participants to log on and work at any hour of the day or night. And then students will be able to participate in many hours of study or minimum hours, depending on how your course is set up, and it can really fit in with your work schedule. Coming up, as far as the next course, is the Excellence in Service for Paratransit Managers. That's July 19th through 24th, and you can learn about that on our website. And then we have distance learning events, including teleconferences and webinars. And of possible interest to you, kind of related to this topic, is our selected topics on Accessible Transportation Stats series. It's called Using the Toolkit for Assessing Bus Stop Accessibility and Safety. And that course comes up on June 17th and 24th from 2 to 3 p.m., two-part skill-building training event. So look to our website. We have a registration deadline on June the 10th. And then we would like you, if you're interested in any of these courses, is to go on to our website and look at www.projectaction.org for more information on any of these training opportunities. And if you have any additional questions, give us a call at 800-659-6428. And just keep in mind that we are the technical assistance resource for you around accessible transportation. So if you have questions, feel free to email me. I got my contact information up there, or contact Project Action at easterseals.com and get in contact with us, and we'll try to help you out with your questions. Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much, Ken. I do encourage everybody, if you have a question or if you want to contact us, please give us a call. I'm going to enter in our phone number again in the chat section because the slide that you're looking at is going to go away here in just a second, but that way the number will be up there for you. The number is also available at the end of the PowerPoint, which was available for download from our website. So with that, I want to introduce our speaker for today's session. Michael Ronkin began working for ODOT in 1984. The first 5 years in construction, where he learned the basics of highway design and road building. From 1989 to 2006, he served as the Bicycle Pedestrian Program Manager, where he helped shape ODOT's proactive pedestrian and bicycle policies. Michael is now president of his own consulting firm, and he's a nationally acknowledged expert in designing streets to better accommodate pedestrians and bicyclists. He can help citizens achieve their goals of placemaking, building livable communities, and reaching consensus on critical design issues. Michael regularly offers training courses to engineers and planners and addresses a variety of audiences on the need to ensure our cities and streets are planned and built with people, not just cars, in mind. We will follow the presentation with questions from you. We'll actually have questions in the middle of the session and at the very end. And at those times, I'll ask our Better World operator to come back and give you instructions on how you can pose your questions to Michael. So with that, I am pleased to turn the session over to Michael.
Thank you very much, and welcome. It looks like we have quite a few people joining us. I want to check that everyone can hear me okay. Christy, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. We had a few technical glitches, and we got over them. Anyhow, that's more or less me on my photo. Add a little bit of gray hair, and that's what I look like about 3 years later. But this isn't about me. Let's move forward and talk about what it takes to make a community accessible. I'm going to talk about three subjects, basically. I'm going to talk about sidewalk design. I'm going to talk about crossings. I'm going to talk about intersections. One subject matter I'm going to spend virtually no time on is ramps, which may surprise a lot of people, because a lot of people think accessibility is all about providing ramps. I always like to say ramps is the last thing you do after you make sure that your community is accessible, and I'll explain that a little bit later. So I'm going to start with sidewalk design. It's pretty surprising to find out that we actually do a very poor job designing and building sidewalks in this country. It sounds so simple that you just basically put a strip of concrete next to the road and people should be able to walk on it. So let's look at a few human factors first that kind of lead us to understand why we have so much trouble making our communities accessible. I've been working in transportation for 25 years, and I came to these conclusions that is the transportation system that we have built, the one for automobiles, makes some pretty basic assumptions that aren't necessarily true. It assumes that people who use this system are able-bodied. It assumes that they can see and that they can hear, and then they understand traffic laws and safety issues, that if there's a sign, they understand what the sign means, for example, or a red light. Well, it turns out that a lot of people are not served by these assumptions. We're leaving out at least one-third, some estimates are 35 to 40% of the population, by basing it on these assumptions. So what we're going to look at today is how can we make sure that we design a transportation system that serves everybody, not just the able-bodied who can see and read and understand traffic signals. The next slide shows us, this is taking a while, isn't it, how people acquire disabilities. Of course, people are born disabled. There are people who become suddenly disabled through an accident. For example, my wife just put out her back and she's been lying in bed the last two, three days taking painkillers. Then slowly over time, I'm just realizing that my left knee is giving out and I'm not quite as agile as I used to be. Some disabilities, of course, are permanent and some are temporary, but the most important point to remember is that they're not all obvious or visible, and you often hear the complaint, well, I don't understand why that person got a disabled parking spot. She seemed fine to me, and we'll talk a little bit about that, too. We're going to talk about these human factors just for a few slides so we can better understand why we design the system in the way that we do. You can see on this slide, for example, the gentleman on the right is making his way through a roundabout, and it's pretty ironic that a police officer is right there. They seem to be interacting. He didn't understand how to get through the roundabout. There's, of course, age. I know very few people who don't plan on getting older, and just recently I spent quite a few years up till his death helping my father get around, and it was really interesting to see how he was losing both mobility and also sensory and cognitive abilities, the ability to see and judge traffic, for example. So you always have to remind ourselves that when we build something, we build it for ourselves, for our own future, and we need to think of ourselves as we get older. Restricted mobility is the most common form of disability that we're designed for, but it's not the only one, for sure. Of course, limited mobility affects your agility, your speed, your endurance, how far you can walk, for example. One of the essential things that are required to make sure that people can get around from a mobility standpoint are firm surfaces, enough width, nothing in their way, ramps, of course, so they can get off the sidewalk onto the street and back on the sidewalk again, and a route that doesn't take too much effort. Other limiting factors, of course, are vision. And one thing we have to make really clear, the term limited vision or vision challenged or whatever term that we use, is not being politically correct. It's just to point out that a person is not completely blind. The vast majority of people who are vision impaired can see something, and then we have to take that into account as we design our system. So, of course, you supplement vision with other sources of information, for example, sound, texture, or high contrast for those who can still see something. And we're not going to get into the technology nowadays of the accessible signals. That's really for a more advanced course. But just to let people understand that with limited vision, there is other ways of providing information. Cognitive is one that we often ignore. If you look at the slide in the upper right, it looks pretty nightmarish from the air. Just imagine you're trying to walk your way through that maze of an intersection, trying to understand where you're supposed to go, which direction you're supposed to be looking for traffic, when it's your turn to cross. Obviously, even a very intelligent person would have trouble with that. Anyone with a cognitive disability is going to have trouble with it, too. And again, the issue, for example, with a roundabout there, and I will make it very clear, I'm a big fan of roundabouts. They do have tremendous safety benefits, but there is no doubt that it is a new skill that one must acquire. So we try to make things as simple as possible, as intuitive as possible, so people with cognitive impairments can find their way through what we build.
Michael, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we've had a couple of requests that you speak a little bit louder.
Okay. I'm turning the telephone towards my mouth. Is that a bit better?
Oh, that's very good. That's
okay,
much better. Good. Thank you.
Good. So, again, the most obvious ones are movement barriers, and this is one of the most common ones here. A ramp was built leading to the street, but there's no ramp at the other end of the street. This is done for a very simple reason. That's with the project limits, and I can assure you this is a project that I worked on. A year or two later, we came by and finished up the rest of the project, and my friend Steve can cross the street now. But movement barriers are ones that are pretty obvious to people. You can see why a person with limited mobility can't get through. What's a little bit more challenging for engineers is to understand what an information barrier is. And this is a very good example right here. If you don't want to hit that scaffolding and those piles of gravel, and you can see and you can understand what that yellow tape means, then you know to go through the passageway that was created. But if a person can't see or understand that information, they're just going to go right through. So that goes back to the point that I made earlier, that we can't just always assume that people will understand what we try to tell them, and very good bad examples of signs that mean absolutely nothing to even very intelligent people. So what we're looking at is, as Ken said earlier, he used the term accessibility several times, but also universal design, making sure that the entire population can use the transportation system, use the streets. I am going to focus mostly on the public right-of-way today and make sure we understand that we integrate these principles into planning and design so people can travel independently. So let's talk a little bit now about sidewalk design. One of the most innovative approaches to sidewalk design that's come about in the last 10 years or so is not thinking of it as simply as a strip of concrete next to the roadway, but a fairly complex system with several zones, four zones. From left to right on the image, we have the curb zone, the furniture zone, the pedestrian zone, and the frontage zone. And for a sidewalk to work well, all four of these elements have to be present, and all four of these elements have to be well designed. And even though it sounds like we're complicating matters, when sidewalks are designed using this principle, they become instantly accessible. That's how you get instant accessibility, is by using the zone system, and we're going to go through these one at a time. One that is often neglected and not thought about is what we call the curb zone. The curb serves two very important functions. The main one is to keep water off the sidewalk when it rains, right, so you don't get puddling on the sidewalk. But another one is to keep drivers off the sidewalk, too. Now, if the drivers let loose at 50 miles an hour, obviously they're going to jump the curb, but in most environments, the curb does provide some cue to the driver. They shouldn't be driving where there are people. It also provides a very important information cue for the vision impaired, and the ramp actually takes away that cue, and that is one of the challenges of accessibility. How do you make sure that people who have a mobility limitation, that is people who need crutches or wheelchairs, can get on and off the sidewalk? So of course you can't have a curb, but then how do you replace that information? The next slide shows you why the curb zone is so critical, like I just said, and that is it is where pedestrians transition from the street to the sidewalk. And you won't believe the number of times I've observed an absolutely perfectly built ramp. If you look at the ramp, it's built entirely to specs, but it doesn't connect to the street, like in this example right here, for example. So what's missing here is good definition in the curb zone. The curb kind of belongs to the street and the sidewalk, both. Well, the next slide illustrates the issue that I just mentioned earlier, and that is preventing cars from parking on the sidewalk. And too many subdivisions back in the 60s, 70s, and still nowadays, are built with what's called mountable curb. They have a slant to them, and if you build a mountable curb, guess what? People will mount them with a car, taking away from sidewalk width. So that's why we recommend against this kind of curb. We prefer the vertical barrier curb. The next zone is the furniture zone. No one zone is more important than the other. They all have their function. What's important about the furniture zone is that's where you put street furniture, including trees, signs, benches, fire hydrants, etc., so they're not where people are walking. They also separate pedestrians from traffic, and in a little bit I'll also explain how they really help make the sidewalks accessible at ramps and at driveways. It's called many different names than just the furniture zone, don't get me wrong, but it's the one that we prefer because it makes it clear that all that stuff has to go there in the furniture zone. We don't want to not have hydrants in case of a fire. We like shrubbery and trees for streetscaping. We know the importance of signs. We just don't want them put in the sidewalk. I always like to joke that you never see a fire hydrant in a travel lane where people are driving. Why do we put them in sidewalks? Well, with the furniture zone, that problem is taken care of. So again, we've gone through two zones, the curb and the furniture zone, that are not where people are walking, but you can see the importance, so it does keep the sidewalk clear, as in this example here. Beautifully landscaped furniture zone, trees, mailboxes, signs, decorations, a little bit of lighting there. All those are great. We need those in an environment. They make the environment richer. We just don't want them where people are walking. They can be used, for example, for bus shelters. In this case, we've got a very generous furniture zone, about 8 feet wide, more than enough room to provide a bus shelter and a sign and a garbage can, completely out of the way of where people are walking. It also enables the person to simply get on the bus when the bus approaches, and the bus can then keep moving. So the furniture zone shouldn't be thought only as a place to get things out of the way. It also has its utility. Then we get to what's called the pedestrian or the walking zone. This is what most people think of as being the sidewalk. It's only one out of four elements. There is a term called the pedestrian access route. This is what we have to make accessible, and this is the only portion of the sidewalk where this matters. The furniture zone and the frontage zone don't have to be accessible, except when you're crossing them, of course. This is the area that you want free of obstacles, protruding objects, and the width, of course, is going to vary more on the usage than anything else. And the next few slides, I'll illustrate some samples of how we arrive at the correct width. The entire time I used to work for ODOT, I used to get calls consistently asking me what is the minimum width of sidewalks recommended by ADA, and people are always surprised when I tell them that ADA does not say anything about sidewalk width itself. It tells you what the minimum passage has to be. And unfortunately, for too long, people thought 3 feet was enough, and 3 feet, as you can see on the left, is simply based on the minimum width that a single wheelchair user needs so he or she can get through without elbows touching anything. As you can see on the right, you need more width for a person with crutches, for example. And the next couple of slides will show you some examples of why greater width is needed. Two people walking side by side, even if they're very close. As this couple is here, the woman is helping her blind husband. They need at least 4 feet, and the person on the right needs at least 5 feet to turn a wheelchair. So there's a lot of confusion when ADA came out in 91, 92, when they talk about these clear widths, and people thought that was the width needed for a sidewalk. In this next example, you see a person in a wheelchair and a person walking next to him need 5 feet, and two people in wheelchairs need at least 6 feet to get by each other. And the reason I'm going through this is to make it sure that people understand that these are just the minimums that are needed for people to get by. So what we recommend in general is that if you do have a separated sidewalk, like the one on the left, the clear area of at least 5 feet of smooth pavement, and if you cannot detach the sidewalk, if it is an attached sidewalk like the one on the right, you're going to need a minimum of 6 feet. That way you do have 2 feet for poles and signs, leaving a clear 4 feet for walking. And then we get to the frontage zone. It's the one that's often neglected. People understand a curb. All engineers know you need a curb to keep drainage in place. People understand the importance of a furniture zone, so you can put in trees and signs, etc. People forget that the frontage zone really matters because it's where the destinations are. Unless you're just going out for a recreational walk around the block, you want to go somewhere, your destination is going to be in the frontage zone. It's also where doors open, it's also where planter boxes, signs on buildings are placed, and it's also an area that must be free of objects so they don't hang out into the pedestrian zone as people are walking by. Next couple of slides illustrate some important architectural factors about the frontage zone. Modern architects seem to love blank surfaces. Most people hate blank surfaces. There's really nothing of interest there. And you can see how this gentleman just instinctively shies away from that wall. It has absolutely no interest to the pedestrian. And the next slide, you can see something quite different. If it comes up, here we go. And that is a very interesting articulated facade with a lot of color, a lot of texture, a lot of variety. And we know this is not a very wide sidewalk for a downtown environment. It doesn't matter as much as it is so rich. Also, an interesting factoid here, you can see that the doors open to the interior like they used to. The fire code now requires doors to open to the outside, which, of course, means they then open onto the sidewalk. So we have to understand that there are different codes out there, and in nearly all cases, the fire code seems to trump everything else. Again, the frontage zone matters as far as comfort goes, psychological and physical. If you compare these two images here, if you took a tape measure, it's pretty obvious that the sidewalk on the left is actually wider than the sidewalk on the right. The sidewalk on the left is about 5 feet. The sidewalk on the right is about 4 feet. But there's no doubt when you do a visual preference survey, everyone says they prefer to walk on the sidewalk on the right, and that is because of the difference of what's in the frontage zone. On the left, you have a very high chain-link fence right at the edge of sidewalk. It makes you feel like you're walking by a prison. You don't really want to be there. On the right is your classic white picket fence. Sit back a little bit, lower, some interesting vegetation. You can see over it. Feels a lot more comfortable, even though technically it's narrower. So it's not just a question of dimensions and plans on paper. It's also an issue of making an interesting environment so people feel like they want to walk. So to summarize the zone system, we've got a little bit of redundancy here with two zones. That's okay. This is a residential neighborhood, and from left to right, you've got the street. If there were parking, you'd be the parking area there, and then the curb zone, and then the furniture zone. And the furniture zone, in this example, you can see grass, of course, a fire hydrant, a speed sign, a utility pole. It looks like an advertisement, probably some garage sale signs a little bit further down. Then the pedestrian zone, and then finally the frontage zone. And you can see how it varies. In the forefront, there's a lawn. It's wide open. And then there's a Western-style fence. They chose to put the fence right at the back of the walk, but it's fairly low, not obtrusive, so it doesn't really matter that much. A lot of jurisdictions require 1 foot minimum setback for fences, which is a really good idea. It gives you that extra foot in there just in case someone puts up a cedar fence or something that is really quite high and makes you want to shy away from it. This example shows the zone system in a much more commercial environment. This is taken, about a block or two away from where my daughter lives in Washington, D.C., a very rich environment. And again, you can see the same elements. The street, this time there are parked cars. Very different types of furniture in the curb zone. You've got trees again, but you have parking meters, you have newspaper boxes, no parking, parking limitation signs, etc. There's no real clear line, but you can see where the pedestrian zone begins and ends, more or less. It is quite wide, a good 8 feet. It's a very busy sidewalk. This is Pennsylvania Avenue. And then the frontage zone, and again, very different from the residential area. You can see some advertising, some planters, some awnings, doors that open to the street. And again, there's no clear line. Those yellow lines are one that I pasted in, but it shows you how sidewalks that really are usable and pleasant to walk on, use all four of these zones. You take away one of the zones, and the sidewalk will not function as well. Like I said earlier, that's probably one of the biggest innovations in sidewalk design in the last 10 or 12 years, and whenever we do our training, we really try to make sure that people understand that, and more jurisdictions around the country are adopting the zone system as part of their code. So again, one more time, to recap, here's an example of a fairly wide, generous sidewalk with a lot of good amenities, nicely organized, so there's a clear path of travel. And then the next slide shows a sidewalk that is just about as wide, with lots of desirable amenities too, but they're randomly arranged, and there is no clear path of travel. No objection to anything that you see here. People who ride a bicycle want bicycle parking. You've got the planters. You've got the City Hall sign. You've got the luminaire, but they're placed so randomly, there's no clear path of travel. This very generous sidewalk is not being used very efficiently. So let's talk about obstacles in the pedestrian zone. Of course, we view them as obstacles. Other people view them as something that is absolutely necessary, for example, power poles. And it's a little bit of a chicken and egg or who got here first type of situation in many cases. One thing we have to understand when we talk about the public right-of-way, we think of it for transportation. And most people understand that transportation involves several modes, driving, public transit, walking, bicycling. But the public right-of-way is also dedicated to utilities. The power companies do have a right to put in their poles there. All that we ask is that they don't put them in the middle of the sidewalk, like you see on this picture right here. So ultimately what you want to do is to plan and design it in such a way so there are no objects in the sidewalk. All right, you can go back and try to eliminate them by more move them or provide access around the object. And that's what we'll talk about next, because once it's there, it's there. And the most common way is just to simply widen the sidewalk a little bit around the pole, so you have that minimum passage that we talked about earlier, that is going to be 4 feet. The pedestrian access route needs to be a minimum of 4 feet, and that's just the bulge around the pole. So it's impossible to build a 4-foot curbside sidewalk and meet the ADA minimums as soon as you put in one single obstacle in the sidewalk, and that's why you have to do these bulges. It's not very graceful, but it is a solution, and it works. Those are the objects that come from the ground that are pretty obvious, such as poles. There are also protruding objects that people aren't aware of, and the image on the left gives you several examples. The tree branch is simply lack of maintenance. The water fountain, ironically, is an accessible water fountain. A person in a wheelchair can access it, but it is turned 90 degrees facing the sidewalk rather than the furniture zone, so a blind person may not see it. You can see a sign which comes protrudes from a building and a planter. All of these things are fine. We're not saying make a sterile environment, get rid of these, just manage it. So on the right, you can see they did prune the branch that was coming out too far into the walking zone. They turned the water fountain 90 degrees, so it's still accessible. We access it from the furniture zone. The sign advertising, whatever business that is, Shewat, was raised. So it's a minimum of 80 inches, and then the planter had to be eliminated, unfortunately. There is another way around this, and that is simply to put a hard object at the bottom. So, for example, that planter could stay if they put a brick or a curb at the bottom of it, so that person with a cane would feel it before they hit it. And that's what that 27 to 80 inches is all about. That's the area that is not detectable by a cane. Anything 27 inches or less, a person who has a cane will detect it before they hit it with their body, which is, of course, much more desirable. So here's an example right here of how a person with just a distraction could easily hit their head there. Obviously, a person with any kind of limited vision will not see it, will definitely bump their head. So that's the essence of sidewalk design just from a dimension point of view. It sounds really simple, and yet it isn't. We all have very vivid examples of sidewalks that are totally dysfunctional because they don't follow the principle of the zone system. And I hope that this short introduction to the zone system has made everyone understand that this is really the way to go as far as sidewalk design. I'm going to quickly run through a few other key ingredients of accessibility. One, of course, is running slope. You can't make your sidewalks too steep. Unless, of course, they follow the grade of the roadway. If the roadway is steep, the sidewalk is the same grade as the roadway. ADA does not require us to level the world and get rid of all hills and all valleys, of course. What is more important to try to understand, since those are topographical limitations we can't do much about, is the side slope. Ideally, 0%, perfectly flat, like in a building, would be preferable, but then it wouldn't drain. You need some slope for drainage. So that's why we've come up with a number of 2%. 2% will drain the sidewalk, but it still does not lean too much for a person in a wheelchair with canes or crutches or a walker. So whenever we say level when it comes to sidewalks, it's not really level, it's 2%. So people understand that when they say that a sidewalk is level, it really has a 2% cross slope. That creates some challenges, though, in the built environment. Buildings and streets settle at different rates. Well, maybe they were built at a time when the architects and engineers didn't understand accessibility and the building was simply built too high. And so if you simply try to build a sidewalk that goes from the curb to the building, you just get a sidewalk that's way too steep. Conversely, if you make the sidewalk more or less level with the curb, then, of course, you don't have access to the building either. So it can create quite a challenge, especially in places like New Orleans, where I've been doing quite a few workshops where the roads literally are sinking. And this is the ideal solution right here. If you remember, the nice thing about the zone system is realizing you don't have to make the entire sidewalk accessible, just the walking zone. So you can see in this example here, they made the slope in the furniture zone quite steep. They made the slope in the frontage zone quite steep, but the area where people are walking are still level. Technically, that means 2%. And the illustration here is followed up by a slide that shows how this is done. I just want to point out that this is a project that I worked on back in the early 90s. It was designed on 90, 91, 92 or so, before ADA as a law really hit us. And it came out very, very successfully. and there was really no written guidance for it, but the designer with whom I worked on this project understood that he had to create a level environment for the pedestrian. The road and the buildings had settled at different rates, and so the curb simply follows the grade of the roadway. The sidewalk where this young woman is walking follows the grade of the buildings, so all the entrances are accessible. Then all the difference in cross slope is taken out in the furniture zone. That's why it says X percent. It varies. A very ingenious way of meeting that very common and difficult engineering challenge. I'm going to talk quickly about driveways, and then we'll turn it over to a few questions. It's interesting that a lot of people thought driveways didn't matter because the early iteration of ADA that came out, the ADA regs that came out in 91 and 92, never mentioned driveways. Well, just because something isn't mentioned doesn't mean you don't have to build it right. And driveways provide a tremendous challenge for people with, not just people in wheelchairs, people with all kinds of limited mobility and cognitive abilities, too, because that slope really pulls you to the street. And if you're blind, you really don't understand what's going on. You're walking on a fairly level surface, then all of a sudden it starts tilting. And you don't necessarily detect it with your cane if it's a very sharp transition, and you can lose your balance and stability. I chose not to show them here because they're animated. My friend Steve here was very brave. I asked him once to let go of his wheelchair in a driveway, and within a fraction of a second, he was out in the street. Fortunately, there was no traffic at that point. So the design solution for a driveway is this, again, if the sidewalk is separated from the curb, you can see how you can keep the sidewalk level through a driveway, minimum of 4 feet, and all the slope is taken out what we call the driveway apron. And the next slide will illustrate that even more clearly. It shows you several different perspectives. Here are two different perspectives of how separation can really help. One more time, we'll keep coming back to that point over and over again. So you can see how the sidewalk stays level, and the planting strip is where the driveway slope is taken out. Now, there are maximum slopes to allow an automobile to get in, and that depends a lot on the amount of overhang. So if you drive like a 57 Chrysler with about 4 feet of overhang in front and 5 feet of overhang in the back, I'm only slightly exaggerating, it might be hard to get up a steep driveway, but modern cars, more and more, the wheels at the front and the back, and they can go up very steep driveway slopes. And in my opinion, I'd much rather put the burden on the car than on the person walking on a sidewalk. So that's why we favor this design right here. And then I'll just talk a little bit about surfacing. We do want something to be firm, slip-resistant, and stable, and there is no doubt after about 2,000 years of experience, the Romans invented concrete, it turns out to be by far the best material for sidewalks. It really meets all of these requirements. There is a desire out there to create something more aesthetic using cobblestones and bricks and pavers, etc., but they do increase rolling resistance. They can create tripping hazards, they can be hard to maintain, and they can create very painful vibrations for people who have brittle bones or other forms of disability in their spine. For example, in the 70s, exposed aggregate was very popular. Bricks in historic districts are very important. They have to be well laid and well maintained to provide the smooth surface, as you see in this photo here. I think we all know what brick pavement looks like. If it's not well maintained, then they start heaving because the tree roots. What we recommend against are these landscape pavers. These really are for use in your garden. They're not intended for use on sidewalks because they're so beveled. They've got this pillow type of look on the top, and that can create a lot of vibration, a lot of rolling resistance, and women in high heels, for example, can get their heel caught and break off in there. So I don't think that film is seen from Sex and the City on a sidewalk like this. There is a solution out there, and that is, again, getting back to the furniture zone, to the zone system. If you simply make sure that the accessible route is smooth and then the walking area, you can pretty much do what you want. And here is a very good illustration of it right here. This is in Philadelphia, and you can see how the walking area is made of concrete, and the furniture and the frontage zones, where there's going to be obstacles anyhow, are made out of brick pavers. And that is what we recommend to citizens and elected officials and landscape architects who want to make the sidewalks look a little bit more lively. We say, fine, just make sure that you maintain a smooth area where people are going to be walking. And I think that is the point at which we take some questions. Yes. Okay, good. So again, I just covered the basics of sidewalk design. We're ready for a few questions just based on what I've talked about here. We'll talk about crossings and intersections next.
All right. Thanks, Michael. LaTanya, if you would come back and provide instructions on how people can ask questions.
Thank you. And at this time, I would like to inform you, in order to ask a question, please press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, in order to ask a question, please press star 1 now. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press star 1.
I'll just, while we're waiting to see if anybody has a question, you can also type your question into the chat section. We will monitor those throughout the rest of the session and read those to Michael as they come in if they're appropriate and if we have time. And if you do ask a question that we don't get to, then you can give us a call after the session and we'll help you with that. And if we have any questions now, we'll take them. But, LaTanya, if we don't, we can move on.
We do have questions.
Oh, great. Go ahead.
Okay, your first question comes from the line of George from Virginia.
Yes, I had a question relative to when is it warranted to have like a 6-inch curb or some type of guard or handrail adjacent to sidewalk?
Sure, yes. Okay, the question was when is it warranted to have some kind of rail adjacent to sidewalk? That is usually met address in the building code, but quite a few design guidelines are addressing that question now, and it's a question of height of drop-off and what there is to be falling onto. It's really quite surprising the building code doesn't require any kind of a handrail until it reaches a height of something like 30 inches, which is really surprisingly high if you think about it, but most people understand the need for something at quite a bit lower height, and usually the guidelines do a combination of looking at the height, the slope, and what it is you're going to be falling onto. It's pretty obvious that if you fall onto grass, it's not as serious as falling onto the roadway. So there are no hard and fast guidelines as far as ADA goes, though any kind of a ramp to a building requires railing, of course. Stairs require railing, too. But adjacent to a sidewalk, guide, for example, does address that.
Okay, thank
no
you.
Hard requirements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Bonnie, do we have another question?
We do, and your next question comes from the line of M from Massachusetts.
Good afternoon. I have a question regarding texture surfaces done in concrete, they call it pressed concrete here in Boston. I think they're interpreting that is it doesn't have as deep a seams as bricks and garden pavers and cobblestones, and that it's being treated as acceptable, and the whole sidewalk is being done, or it's done in swirly designs to make a bigger picture if you stood and hung over it like a bird. So I actually find them to be very bumpy. So is there more information on texture surfaces, or are there regulations that say it only can be in a certain area, or that the pressing shouldn't be so deep?
Right, yeah, that's a very good question. And just so you know, I'm with you. I speak to a lot of architects, and they say making overly interesting sidewalks really takes away from what people should be looking at, which is more or less at eye height, which is other people and buildings and places of interest. So there's something wrong, in my opinion, with making overly designed sidewalks. And, yeah, pressed into the concrete is probably not as bad as these different real cobblestones. They can still create a bumpy surface. There is a limit to what you can have, and that is no more than a quarter inch. But the problem is, if a person is using some kind of assistive device, let's say like a walker, a quarter-inch bump every 3 or 4 feet is not so bad, but a quarter-inch bump every few inches is going to create a painful vibration. There's no doubt about that. So that's the only thing that is addressed in ADA, that you cannot have more of a difference in height than a quarter inch, which doesn't seem like a lot, but if you sew that in every few inches, it is going to be very painful. So I would recommend that you use that image that I showed you of Philadelphia to point out that they can do fancy textured work in their sidewalks if they want, but to try to keep one area at least 4 feet, preferably 6 to 8 feet wide, that is clear of those bumps, especially in a plaza-type area that's going to take you in different directions. So, yeah, I'm totally with you on that one. I think it's been overdone.
What I think I'm finding is there's no money for public artwork, so they're mixing the public artwork is being combined into the sidewalk. That's
and that's okay.
Design.
Just drop the texture. Just have them drop the texture. That's all.
And,
great.
And they actually feel that, well, it's acceptable. So thank you for this, because I went out and it was terrible, and it was more bumpy than people think.
But the proof is in the pudding, and you can meet specs and have it fail, and obviously it failed since it didn't satisfy you. You have to remember that ADA is about people, not specs.
Great. I would think I will use that when I speak to them. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you for your question. LaTanya, we'll take one more before we move on.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you. That will be from the Opus International.
Hello?
Hello. Yes?
Hello?
Yes.
Your question, please.
Okay. So you say that the sidewalk can follow the adjacent street. We're working in a community where the adjacent streets have quite steep slopes, 8-10%. They're building up a mountain. And it's creating some issues at intersections, even with level ramp landings that it's pretty high speed. You know, wheel users could get to pretty high speed on approaches to intersections. Are there any guidelines about reducing sidewalk gradient on the approach to intersections?
Yes, there are. Like I said, you're right. The actual street itself, if it's a 10%, the sidewalk can be a 10%. There's nothing you can do about that. But the intersections have to be leveled. And I am going to talk about crosswalks in the next section. And the crosswalk has to be leveled too. So it's called tabling an intersection. When two streets meet, one at a grade, they do have to do what's called tabling, so the intersection has to be level, and they have to extend into the crosswalks, so the crosswalks are level, too.
Okay. And how about the approaches to the intersection?
Yeah,
like, does it need a bit of space to slow down?
I decided not to go into the detail of ramp design, but you don't have to go any more than 15 feet. I mean, if the street is at 10% and the ramp can be a maximum of 8%, that's obviously physically impossible to do that. So all that you're required to do is build the ramp 15 feet and whatever grade that is. So if your speed is at 10% and you go up 15 feet, your ramp is probably going to be about 12 to 15%. And that's just the nature of geometry. Nothing can be done about that. But there is a limitation of 15 feet.
Okay.
And I just got one question on the Internet. What about trees, shrubs that have a huge overhang on a sidewalk? That's an issue of maintenance. You still have to maintain that area clear. It's interesting that ADA requires 80 inches. Most jurisdictions require 7 feet, that's 84 inches. So it's a question of making sure that the adjacent property owner maintains trees and shrubs. And oftentimes those trees and shrubs are in public ownership and sometimes in private ownership. And it's simply a question of maintenance.
All right. Thank you for your questions. And Michael, I think we'll go ahead and take the rest of the questions at the end.
Great. Okay. We have about half an hour. I don't know if we'll finish all these. I am going to talk next about street crossings and intersection design, because that is the critical component when it comes to accessibility and safety. Like I said, sidewalk design is not that easy, but we need to make sure that people can cross the street safely. Most people, when they get hit by a car, it's not on a sidewalk. It's when they cross the street. You have to be able to determine when and where to cross the street. Remember, I talked about cognitive limitations earlier. Well, this person is visually challenged. He's actually completely blind. He cannot see approaching traffic, so he is basing it on sounds, whether or not it's safe to cross the street. It's a two-way street, no pun intended. The victim is usually the pedestrian. The perp, if we're going to use those kind of terminology, is usually the driver. And both have to understand what's going on. All too often, the driver will say, the pedestrian came out of nowhere, I didn't see the pedestrian. Well, I'm sorry, pedestrians do not suddenly materialize in front of drivers. They do come from somewhere. And it's usually really quite clear, it should be quite clear, that the pedestrian wants to cross the street. The biggest challenge to street crossings in America are the absurd widths to which we've designed our highways. In my opinion, a highway should never, ever have more than 4 travel lanes, 2 in each direction. Anything more than that does not help with level of service and makes it a very daunting challenge for people to cross. It takes longer to cross, more conflicts with vehicles, slower pedestrians can't get all the way across. Very hard for people who are blind who have any kind of vision limitations to track their way through the crosswalk. And if it's a signalized intersection and you're giving the pedestrians their own face to cross, it's going to hold up traffic that much longer, too, to let the pedestrian cross. The second most important, the second other critical element as far as street crossing goes is speed, the speed of traffic. People just drive too fast in urban areas. This is, again, my opinion, but we should not allow anyone to go any faster than 30 miles an hour in any built-up environment. 35, 40, and 45-mile-an-hour streets simply shouldn't exist in urban environments. I don't know if you understand this, but I'm a consultant. I'm American, but I just moved to Switzerland. And in Switzerland, the speed limit in cities is 50 kilometers an hour, just 30 miles an hour. You simply are not allowed to drive faster where there are people. And the reason is it just takes so much longer to react and to bring your car to a stop. As you can see from this chart, it's an exponential relationship. It takes more than twice as long at 20 miles an hour than 10 miles an hour. And look how much longer it takes to stop a car at 30 and 40 miles an hour. So when people say they didn't have time to stop, it's usually because they're going too fast. It also dramatically increases the chance of a serious disabilitating injury or death. Again, an exponential relationship from 20 to 30 miles an hour, that's the speed when an impact occurs. It goes from 5 to 45% chance of death or disabilitating injury. When you go from 30 to 40 miles an hour, it doubles again. So you can see by keeping speeds low, people can stop in time for a pedestrian, and if they do by chance hit a pedestrian, at least the pedestrian won't get killed at lower speeds. It is probably, not probably, it is absolutely the silver bullet when it comes to safety, one that we're not willing to admit, and that is if everyone just slowed down, our crashes would be reduced tremendously. Let's talk a little bit about crosswalks. People don't understand the utility of crosswalks very well. Crosswalks have two functions. One is to indicate to pedestrians a place to cross. It provides good information for people with visual limitations. And it also tells the drivers where to expect pedestrians. That's why the markings must be clearly visible to both the pedestrian and the driver. It also establishes the right-of-way, too. So let's look at the different types of markings. The one at the top is one that's most commonly used in the United States. We're the only country in the world that uses them all over the world. Everyone else has gone to longitudinal markings, which you can see are much more visible to the driver. A crosswalk that is not visible to the driver doesn't really serve one of its two functions. And the next slides, I'll illustrate that. So these are the minimum that are required. Simply 2 white lines. These are 8 inches wide. You can go as narrow as 6 inches. And you can see, a person who can see, if you've got good vision, you can see this crosswalk. So you're standing by the street, you see the crosswalk, and you say, aha, an engineer thought this is a place where I should cross. Here is a crosswalk. Of course, people don't consciously think that. Subconsciously, though, that's what it tells you. And look at that very same crosswalk from about 250 feet away. From the driver's perspective, it totally disappears. You've really done a disservice to the pedestrian by telling the pedestrian, here's a place to cross, and not giving the same information to the driver. So again, longitudinal markings, the ones that are parallel to the direction of travel, are going to be a lot more visible to the driver and the pedestrian also, as you can see in these 2 examples right here. The next slide illustrates a very cool new design. It's actually not that new. It came out of King County, the Seattle area, in the early 80s, almost 30 years ago. One of the common complaints about longitudinal markings is that it takes more material, either more paint or thermoplastic if you're going high-tech, and that it costs more to put down, and then maintenance crews complain because they have to go back and maintain them. Well, if you group the markings like this, 2x2, and put them out of the wheel path where the cars drive, it really reduces wear and tear and maintenance. because the cars skip over them. You can see already a little bit of wear pattern on that roadway. This photo was taken about a year after the road was paved and the crosswalk markings were put in. Drivers don't go over them, and they stay in place a lot longer. It also, as you can see from the next slide, really dramatically increases visibility. So not just the fact that they're longitudinal, but the fact that they're staggered really catches your attention. So this is a crosswalk that serves that dual function. It tells the pedestrian a place to cross, and it tells the driver there's going to be pedestrians crossing here. In my opinion, we should just get rid of those transverse markings. I don't know why they're still allowed. Now, there are some complaints from people about some of these thermoplastics. If they keep maintaining them year after year and they build up, they can become quite bumpy. There's no doubt about that. So here's a very elegant solution that Salt Lake City has come up with. They make the crosswalk very wide, about 12 feet, big bold stripes, and they leave an area in the middle, a gap in the middle, so a person who's using a walker or a wheelchair won't get a bumpy ride as they cross the street. Because we have to remember, we want people to be able to cross the street as quickly as possible, which is why we're going to come back to colored and textured crosswalks. They look really good on architectural renderings. They're really bright and visible, but people don't understand what kind of a challenge they can create when they're actually placed on the street. So, again, they seem to not fulfill one of those two functions that I talked about. Here's a brick crosswalk that was installed about 8 years before I took this picture. The red has faded, but still, a person with good vision can still see the crosswalk. And on the next slide, we'll illustrate what the driver sees, which is virtually nothing, if the slide ever comes up. There it is. A few people say, I didn't even know that was a crosswalk. I thought that was some kind of utility cut. So again, if your crosswalk is not visible to the driver, it has not fulfilled its function. The next slide illustrates the problems with overdoing the texture. This is an example right here where they tried using three different textures. You see you got the asphalt of the road, or four, if you count from the right. You got the asphalt of the roadway. Actually, you got five, I think. A concrete curb, red brick, stone, alternating again, another curb, and then brick pavers on the roadway. And then, of course, when it fails, they patch it with asphalt. So it doesn't even fulfill its original intent of aesthetics. I think most of us will agree this is quite ugly. And it makes it very difficult for a person with any kind of mobility limitations to cross the street. And remember, that's why we want people to get out of the street as quickly as possible. We don't want to slow them down when they're crossing the street. This is the ideal. I found this in Orlando, Florida. They're discovering that a lot of their older residential streets were paved in brick. So they're ripping out the asphalt and they're just leaving it in the crosswalk. This makes total sense. Have a bumpy ride for the driver and a smooth ride for the pedestrian. That's the kind of world I want to live in. But that is a very, very rare example, but there's no reason why we can't emulate that. Let's talk a little bit now about crossing techniques. There is no doubt that the pedestrian's best friend when it comes to crossing a busy roadway is the median or island. Instead of crossing both directions of travel at once, a pedestrian simply has to perform two simpler tasks, and that is judge whether there is a traffic conflict on the left, and if there isn't, then you proceed to the island, and then you judge if there's a traffic conflict coming from the right. So, of course, pedestrians who can see use visual cues by looking, and pedestrians who need sound cues use the sound of traffic. If there's no traffic coming from the left, they proceed, and if there's no traffic coming from the right, they proceed on the second half of their crossing. It makes it so much easier to cross the street in two steps. So this woman just finished looking left for traffic. She's now approaching the island, and you can see how she's already starting to turn ahead, judge the second part of her crossing. She did not have to worry about traffic coming from her right when she first crossed the street. Remember when you were a kid, you were told to look left, look right, look left again? Well, with an island, you can forget that. You look left, you cross the island, and then you look right. It dramatically reduces crashes and makes it so much easier to find the gap in traffic because you're not trying to find a gap in all lanes of traffic, just half the traffic at once. Someone just asked about surface paint for crosswalks. Aren't some more slippery than others? Yes, that's true, but you can throw sand, something gritty, in with the paint, and that will make it less slippery. And this slide seems to be taking a while. Okay, here's a design detail here. I talked a lot about being able to see traffic. People who are blind and using a cane also need some guidance. And this median is a little bit offset, so it forces people to turn to the right and look for traffic. And people who are using a cane for guidance, you can see how the last 2 feet are at right angles, perpendicular to the crosswalk, so people who are blind can use that as a cue. You can also see the new texture that's been required for the last 8 or 9 years. So again, the blind person can feel that under their feet, and then they know that they're going to be entering traffic for the second part of their crossing. I want to spend a couple of minutes here talking about one of the biggest threats to pedestrians on multi-lane roadways, which is why we try to urge people to restrain themselves from building overly wide roads, and that's what's called the multiple threat crash. It accounts for a shockingly high percentage of crashes. I think it's 17% of fatal crashes occur because of this. And this happens when one driver politely decides to stop for a pedestrian, let them cross the street. They see the pedestrian, they see the crosswalk, they stop. But they stop so close to the crosswalk that the driver in the second lane and the pedestrian can't see each other, not realizing that they're in conflict and that driver is going to hit the pedestrian at very high speed. There is no room to stop anymore. Here's an illustration of the same idea from above. This time we threw in a pickup truck. So again, the driver of car A is being polite and respectful and law-abiding, stops for a pedestrian. The pedestrian starts to cross, and you can see the critical point here. The pedestrian is about halfway in the first lane. The car in the second lane is not slowing down, and if that pedestrian and the car proceed, they are going to crash. It can often result in a fatal crash because the car is going at full speed. If this is a 40-mile-an-hour roadway, that driver is doing 40, 45 miles an hour, and the pedestrian will most likely get killed or very severely injured. So what we recommend is at crosswalks or multi-lane roads, we put what's called an advanced stop line. That is, the line is set back about 30 feet from the crosswalk. That way, if the driver does stop the pedestrian, then the pedestrian can see past car A and see that car B isn't stopping. It does not allow the driver of car B time to stop the pedestrian. It's too late if car B is not slowing down, but at least allows the pedestrian to take evasive action. It also can help a blind pedestrian too, because if car A stops back about 30 feet, there will be that little bit of a silence as the engine of car A revs down to an idling speed, and then, since it's set further back, it's more easy for the blind pedestrian to tell, hey, wait a minute, I can hear another car approaching at higher speed, so they're not too close to the idling engine that could mask the sound of the car in the second lane. So even for visually impaired pedestrians, this is very useful. It is an absolutely amazingly simple principle that can dramatically reduce crashes that should be used virtually everywhere. Sheila Parrott just asked here, are stop lines legal in yield states? Yes, I know what that means. Only 13 states have a requirement for drivers to stop for pedestrians. The 37 other states require drivers to yield to a pedestrian. But in most cases, you can read the language as yield really meaning stop. And a friend of mine who is a professional traffic engineer says, yes, you can use stop lines in states that require to yield. Because to yield, you really have to stop anyhow. I'll see if I have time to address the roundabout question in a second. Do you think advanced stop lines should be used routinely or just as a countermeasure? Absolutely yes. In my opinion, no crosswalk should ever be placed on a multi-lane road without an advanced stop line. I retired from my job at the Oregon Department of Transportation in 2006, and I'm proud to say that's one of my prime achievements, I would say. In 2002 or so, I did manage to make it a requirement that all crosswalks or multi-lane roads shall have an advanced stop line. Why wait for a crash to happen before you do something that you know can prevent a crash, right? So here's an example of it right here on a six-lane road, three in each direction in Las Vegas, and you can see the driver with that blue car stopping further back. The pedestrians are just starting to cross now. If they proceed, they will be able to see whether a car in the third lane is stopping or not. So even though I said I wouldn't talk about ramp design detail. There's so much literature on that. I do want to spend just the last few slides talking about ramp placement at intersections, because I've seen way too many ramps that are perfectly built. You take out a tape measure and level, and you measure it. It's absolutely to spec, and yet it's absolutely unusable because it is not placed correctly. Ramps have to be placed within the crosswalk. Two are preferred. You want to keep the crossing short, but you also want to place the crossing at the intersection so drivers expect you. And the next few slides illustrate that. This is a problem with a single ramp at an intersection. It does force the person in a wheelchair or anyone who needs to use the ramp, someone with crutches, for example, sometimes, or someone with a walker, has to go a little bit out of direction. You can see how the other pedestrian is just going straight across. So you're adding a few seconds to the crossing time, and the person has to do a little bit of a wiggle there to get back into the crosswalk. This next slide illustrates it. Coming from the other direction, the person is in the roadway, has almost hit the end of their crossing, and then has to go out of direction, adding a few feet, adding a few seconds to their crossing, which can be very confusing to drivers. Drivers will often start accelerating again when they think the pedestrian is out of their way, and that pedestrian is still in the crosswalk because you have to go an extra 10 or 15 feet for the crossing. Here's another example right here of a single ramp placed diagonally at the apex, and with curb extensions, this is absolutely inexcusable. They should have put two at each corner. The red line illustrates where people want to go, where able-bodied people who can get up and down a curb will go, and who people who need the ramp, in theory, that's the solid yellow line, will get back to the crosswalk, but we all know that, of course, they're not going to do that. They're just going to make a beeline, that dash line, for the next crosswalk, which has some interesting legal repercussions, because if a pedestrian were to be hit in that situation, they would not have the protection or law. They would technically be found at fault because they were not, quote-unquote, in the crosswalk, which is doing a terrible disservice. So crosswalks should always be placed where people are going to cross, rather than saying people should always cross in a crosswalk. That is an absurd statement. The true statement is place crosswalks where people are crossing. Don't force people to go to a crosswalk if it's out of direction. Just going to spend the last couple of minutes talking about intersection design here. It's very, very tricky to do. And with very tight radii, it is so much easier. I have no idea what those black dots are. They're just something that showed up in this PowerPoint, so please excuse that. Just look at the ramps and the crosswalks and how with a tight radius, that means a very sharp corner, it is possible to place two ramps, have them perpendicular to the crosswalk, and have the crosswalk be where people want to cross the street. That's the blue line. When you increase the radius, when you make a large sweeping turn, so drivers can more easily make a turn, which means they can take the turn at high speed and more easily hit a pedestrian, if the slide ever comes up, you can see that the crosswalks can no longer be where they were. The white lines are where the crosswalks were on the previous slide. The dashed line shows where the curb used to be. This is impossible. You can't have crosswalks hanging out there. So with a large radius, we're now forced to make some kind of a compromise. A lot of engineers choose to do this solution, and that is put the crosswalk far from the intersection at the beginning of the straight section to keep the crossing shorter. So yes, technically the crossing of the road is shorter, but you can see how it adds considerable out-of-direction travel, about 30 feet one way across the street, 30 feet back again. It also removes the pedestrian from the intersection proper, so right and left-turning drivers don't even know there's a crosswalk there because it's around the corner. So that's a solution that's often recommended that has quite a few drawbacks, as you can see. Sometimes with a large radius, if it ever comes up, we are forced to put in a single ramp, as in this case here, but with creative designs and putting the two curb ramps really close to each other, as you'll see in the next slide right here, it's sometimes possible to get it so that everything fits in fairly well. That is, the crosswalks and the ramps and the sidewalk all line up with just a little bit out of direction travel, and you really have to apologize. Something happened in the transfer of the PowerPoints here. Just imagine that those geometric shapes that you see in those corners are the ramps placed at the crosswalk there. The most important point that we're trying to make in this series of slides is the fact that large radii are the enemy of pedestrianism. It is very, very difficult to do this light when the radii, the coronal radius, are large. It enables drivers to make the turns at very high speeds, and it makes it very, very difficult to pace the crosswalks correctly. All the time I work for ODOT and as a consultant now, it's really quite shocking the different perspectives. Good urban designers understand that a radius should be between 5 and 15 feet. A lot of state DOTs won't consider a radius less than 30 feet and would prefer to have them 40, 45, even 50 feet sometimes. So there's a huge disconnect between what a lot of state departments of transportation would like to see to enable traffic to flow smoothly and what a lot of good urban designers would like to see to make a more pedestrian-accessible environment. So that's all the detail I wanted to talk about as far as ramps. I wanted to make sure that we covered in what's, in my opinion, a far more important subject, making sure that they're placed correctly. So I hope that what you retain from this is the best way to design sidewalks is to use the zone system, that the best way to make the streets crossings safe and accessible is to slow traffic down and to keep the streets narrow. And there's a lot of information out there on how to design ramps. More important is how to place them in such a way that people will use them. So we have about seven or eight minutes for a few more questions. Should I just take this first one that showed up here about curb bump outs?
Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. Curb bump outs are curb extensions. They have several names. Really are a great tool. They're used on streets with on-street parking to bring the curb further out. So if your parking lane is 7 feet wide, you gain 7 feet of sidewalk. It enables the pedestrian to be seen by the driver. It also enables the pedestrian to see traffic if they're blind. It enables them to hear traffic more easily, they're closer to the roadway. It also provides opportunities to slow traffic down when they make the right turn. And very often they're used for putting in trees, bus shelters, bicycle parking if you make them big enough. They really do have a lot of advantages. And kind of like the advanced stop line, in my opinion, on streets with on-street parking, they should be the norm. People should ask for an exception to not put in a bump out. There's so many advantages.
And all right.
I'll let you answer that question about are the slides going to be available.
Yeah, we're going to provide a link to that on the chat section.
Great. Okay, so we have time for some verbal questions now.
LaTanya, could you give the instructions one more time?
Absolutely. At this time, I would like to remind everyone, in order to ask a question, simply press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, for questions, please press star 1 now.
And while you're populating the list of questioners, I'm going to ask Michael to address some questions that we received in advance. So, Michael, I'm just going to read these to you. I think we'll start with this one. Could you make suggestions on the best way to prioritize ADA improvements when there are many improvements that need to be made?
Yes. If you remember what I said earlier, it's all about destinations, right? So you think about the most common destinations in a neighborhood that a city or whatever scale it is, it can be village or city, that enable us to be social beings, right? So it can be the school, it can be the post office, it can be the grocery store, it can be city hall, it can be the parks, it can be visiting your neighbors. You really need to think in terms of nexuses, I think I suppose nexus, right, and destinations and how to link them together. And the second priority would be filling in gaps. If there is a mostly complete sidewalk system and there's a 50, 60-foot gap, it makes a lot more sense to fill in gaps rather than go out and building new sidewalks. So that would be my two main recommendations. Look at the destinations that people need to get to and look at filling in gaps.
All right. Thank you so much. The next one is, shouldn't parking changes that reduce driving come before slowing down traffic and other access changes for complete streets to create space to complete sidewalks, make safe routes to transit and bike lanes, etc.?
Okay, well, we just hit on the holy grail here of transportation, and that no one wants to talk about. Everyone thinks that transportation is all about roads and mobilities and trains and buses and walking and bicycling. People always look at Our transportation is mobility, so as we look at objects that move, what people don't understand is the most critical factor in determining how successful a city is in managing its transportation is parking. The more parking you supply, the more people will drive, the more people drive, the wider the roads that you need, and then it becomes a downward spiral. Every city that's got good public transit, that people walk a lot, that people bike a lot, that are considered the most livable cities, has very, very restricted and expensive parking. If it's hell to find a parking space, that's a really good sign. If it's easy to find cheap parking, it's probably not a very desirable place to be. And then, again, your roads end up overly wide. So it's interesting that Gladwin hit on it immediately, and I would say only a small percentage of people in the transportation field are starting to realize that parking drives transportation, urban transportation, not the other way around. That is a pretty great question.
All right. We'll take one more of the questions received in advance, and then we'll take a couple from the phone. This is from Peggy, and she writes that she's interested in the research on viewing the environment and pedestrian access from the perspective of movement along paths of travel, with an emphasis on intersections for persons with cognitive impairments. Could you discuss any research that you're aware of?
Not research per se, but there's no doubt that empirically we do know that the simpler right-angle tight intersections that you get in the older cities that were built on a grid are much more easily accessible and intuitive for people who have cognitive impairments than the big suburban intersections with turn lanes and multiple approaches and skews and large radii. So it gets back to the general principles that I talked about of intersection design. That's KISS, keep it simple, stupid. That means really try to limit the amount of information that a person has to process before crossing the street, because, you know, a crash is always the result of one of the two parties misinterpreting information out there. They just didn't understand what the other party was doing, and they just proceeded into each other's path. It's a very simplistic way of looking at a crash, but usually it happens because one or both of the parties didn't process the information correctly. And so the less information there is that you have to process, the simpler it's going to be.
All right. Thank you so much, and thank you to those who put your questions in ahead of time. LaTanya, we'll take a couple questions.
Thank you. Your first question comes from the line of Don from Washington.
Don?
Don, your line is open.
Don from Milwaukee?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. My question is, are there any recommendations you would have in terms of design with the advent of greater numbers of electric or hybrid cars for people who have visual impairments or people who may not be aware who key off of the sound of approaching vehicles?
Right. Yeah, this has been something that's been discussed quite a bit in the last few years. As cars are getting quieter, most people applaud it, of course, and then you do come to realize that that is one of the cues that people who have visual impairments use to judge whether or not it's safe to cross traffic. And there are several solutions that are being looked at. One is actually adding something that would make a noise, and that worries me a little bit because I could see every manufacturer running out there coming up with some cute idea, and then we get into that whole beep, beep, chirping nightmare we got about 15 years ago with those traffic signals that made noises, if you remember, because there was no standard. And so that is one idea that is thought about, and that would be that a vehicle does have some artificial kind of noise maker, but in my opinion, it would have to be really consistent, and it would have to sound like a motor, because a person who was born blind, that's a sound that they've learned to recognize, so let's not throw in something electronic and high-tech at them. Another possible solution is to have cars have sensors, and that worries me also, because it's also taking away from the driver's task. That is a car that would sense an approaching pedestrian. So I love quiet cars, don't get me wrong, but in my opinion, the burden should still be on the driver rather than the pedestrian to look out for pedestrians. It's still reversing the burden of proof. We're still asking the pedestrian to take evasive action when it's really up to the driver to not hit a pedestrian.
Can you do anything with road noise?
No, that doesn't work because it's too late. That's been tried, rumble strips and things like that. If the rumble strip is about You cannot place a rumble strip at the right place in such a way that by the time the car drives over it and makes the rumbling sound, the pedestrian can react. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes.
If you put it too far away, the pedestrian can't hear it, and if you put it too close, it's too late. So that has been tried. You know, they tried 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 feet, and there absolutely was no distance that enabled the pedestrian both to hear it and react in time. But, yeah, it's a good idea, don't get me wrong, but it has not proven to be effective.
So it looks like there's really nothing at this point that looks like it would be an elegant solution.
Well, yeah, I already said it. Drivers beware. I mean, in my opinion, it's up to the driver to look out for pedestrians.
I don't trust them.
All right, thank you for your question, Doc. All right, Latanya, we're a little over. We're going to take one more question, and then if we don't get to your question today, I encourage you please to give us a call, and we'll address your questions after the call. But we'll take one more question.
Yeah, I don't mind taking a few afterwards offline, too, if you want to email. If there's a technological way for them to send you questions.
Okay, absolutely. Whatever calls we get, we will make sure and confer with you on those and get the answers to the participants.
Sure, got it. Let's take one more.
Thank you. At this time, there are no further questions.
Oh,
well, that's easy. That works out perfectly then. Okay, thank you so much, Latanya. Unfortunately, we have used up our time today. There were a couple of chat room questions that we didn't get to. I'm sorry, Michael?
I tried to answer a few, and Jeff answered one.
Oh, you actually answered several of them, but there were just a few that we missed. So if you would like to give us a call afterwards, please do so, and we'll do our best to get your questions addressed. I know that we want to thank Ken for the information about Project Action and Michael especially for the great presentation. I also want to thank BetterWorld and Let's Go Expo for the assistance with the technology for today's session. And thank you especially to those of the participants that joined us today. If you're interested in obtaining the transcript of the program, you can go to our website at projectaction.org in about 30 to 45 days, and you can download the PDF or text version. If you want to get the transcript in Braille or audio CD, you can make that request to espadistancelearning@eastersills.com. Michael, do you have any final comments?
No, I thought it went very well. I really appreciate the opportunity to do this, and I hope I hit on the subject matters that enable people to get the most out of the short amount of time that we've had.
All right. Thank
really
you so much.
It's condensed to just an hour and a half, I can tell you.
Great. I think it was great. Thank you so much, everybody, for your participation. And we hope that each of you will participate tomorrow in the final session on the online conference on pedestrian access. The registration information and dial-in number were included on your confirmation email when you registered. After the final session tomorrow, we will email a link to everyone that registered with an evaluation. We'll also provide it on our website, so if you didn't register and are participating with someone else, you can go to our website and find that evaluation. And we ask that you just take a few moments to give us your feedback concerning the effectiveness of this series of sessions. And we just take that very seriously when we improve our sessions for the future. Most importantly, thank you so much for your commitment to bringing together the disability community and the transportation industry to improve accessible transportation in your community. Have a great day.